Cultivate Simple, episode 25, Planting for Pollinators.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainsides. I'd rather see your I'd rather swim the ocean. I'd rather not pretend. I'd rather do some thinking now.
Welcome to Cultivate Simple, an honest and unrehearsed discussion about trying to live a more simple life. This is episode 25, and today we're talking about planting for the pollinators. For the bees, for the wasps, for the butterflies,
hummingbirds,
anything that
bumblebees,
anything that's going to help you do your job. It's really interesting when you start to talk about pollinators, because without pollinators, what did she says it in the beginning of the talk? But mm-hmm. It's something. I mean, it's in the billions of dollars worth of food products that rely on pollinators. And yet, you know, not many people think about them.
Right. And we, you know, we often just think about the honeybee. But in reality, the honeybee is such a small, part of the pollinators. They're not native to this country. We have a lot of native pollinators that, you know, their population's declining, too, because of habitat loss and stuff. And there are a couple things you can do to improve the habitat for your pollinators. Maybe we could do a whole nother podcast about this, like, as opposed to, because this one's about planting. But I've discovered a lot of things through my gardening career that help increase the numbers of pollinators. Just a few simple things that you can do every year. Maybe we could do another podcast about that. Because I could mention them here, but the talk from the library is kind of long. So we're trying to keep this intro fairly small, short,
really short,
compact.
You think that, as one person commented this past week, whenever we say we're going to keep it short, we always go long, just like last week?
Yeah. No, we'll keep this short.
Okay.
Because Deb is great. And I'll tell you that we're going to go back to Avena. Is that how she says it? Mm-hmm. Avena Botanicals?
Mm-hmm.
They have like a 3-acre herb garden, and we saw some pictures already there, and I'm pretty excited to go back this summer and take a bunch of pictures, and I'll definitely be blogging about it, and I think she's going to give us a few different herbs to plant here, so that'll be kind of neat to see it in the height of summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll get to see it then too, since you couldn't see, you know, she had some pictures of all of the different plants that she mentioned, and you know, we can't see those. And I'll also make a note that I wrote down the names of just about everything she mentioned. And I will go ahead and put that in the show notes so that you don't have to be madly trying to write, especially if you're like commuting when you listen to this. But
please do not write while you're driving.
Yeah, but it was interesting as we listened to her talk, because most of the plants she mentioned we had incorporated into our gardens back in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're kind of starting all over here. We have a few things, but you know, we're not sure what all is here because, you know, we haven't seen it at all.
Right.
But I know there's not much. There's not much as far as cultivated, planted garden space that has herbs.
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll definitely be expanding and adding a lot of the things that she talked about. So,
yep. So before we listen to that, just four quick announcements. One is that this past Tuesday, we released the first ebook, which was Seed Starting 101.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have not downloaded that, you can go do that at the website. I'm actually going to put something in the sidebar, which hopefully by the time we put this podcast out, it'll be there. I'll do that tonight, because now it's, you know, lost to the archives.
That's right.
But I'll put something in the sidebar so it's easy to find that ebook, but you can download that. It's a free ebook. Put a lot of time and effort into it, and we've been getting a lot of great feedback from it.
Mm-hmm.
So And when I say we put a lot of time and effort, I mean that Susie put a lot of time and effort. The other thing that we launched this week was the 5x5 challenge. So if you haven't checked out 5x5challenge.com.
So 5x5challenge.com.
I think we also have 5by5.
Oh, yeah? Okay, good.
I think so. I'll have to check on that.
Anyways, yeah, people were pretty excited about that. And we have a bunch of people signing up for the forums. I think there are like 68 introductions over there right now. So if you're going to join, you know, head on over there, join the forum and post your introduction to everybody else that's joining. So,
and if you know of any people that are wanting to get into gardening but don't know what to do or don't know how to do it or are intimidated by it, encourage them to go to 5by5challenge.com. Mm-hmm. And Susie every week is going to be posting blog posts that explain the steps to gardening and what you should be doing that week and so on. So you'll be seeing those posts on the blog. And if you go over to 5by5challenge.com, they'll be linked up there. But the discussion forums are a huge asset because you can get in there, you can ask questions, any question you want. And then there are boards in there for specific regions. So depending on where you live, you can ask region specific questions. So that was announcement number two. Announcement number three is that this week we are interviewing Hank Will and possibly his wife Karen, depending on her scheduling and if she can make it. We're going to be interviewing Hank, and he is the editor of Grit Magazine, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. And he's also on a TV show called Tough Grit that Grit Magazine does with TSC, the Tractor Supply Company. So we're going to be interviewing him this week about he and Karen's book,
Plowing
with Pigs, which is... I'm going to talk to him about the title because I think it was because it's kind of a general homesteading, but homesteading sort of level two. It's not introduction to homesteading.
Yeah. And it's not like urban homesteading. This is more for people who live
a little bit more rurally.
Yeah.
I mean, the principles could be applied, but it's a little more... rural. It's interesting. It'll be interesting to talk to him and to find out how the book came about, and also just to talk to him in general. Plus he's into rabbitry, and we're going to be starting to get our rabbits here pretty soon, so I have a few questions for him on that and other general homesteading topics. So we'll be picking his brain this Tuesday, and I think that show will be coming out next week, so stay tuned for that. Finally, of course, if you get any value out of this podcast or out of the 5x5 Challenge or out of the ebook or out of anything else that we do, please give us a little bit of value back, and you can do that by going to cultivatesimple.com, and in the sidebar there is the donate links. You can sign up for a $5 a month recurring donation, or you can give a one-time donation. And when the ebook was launched this week, we received five or six donations with really nice notes, you know, people saying that they just love the ebook, that, you know, they're just starting their seeds and it's just going to really come in handy, beautiful photos, so on and so forth. It's just some really good feedback there. So people found value in it and they gave value back, and we appreciate that. So without further ado or further announcements, this is...
Deb Sewell.
Yeah, planting...
For pollinators.
For pollinators. Enjoy. This is not Deb Sewell. This is Brian again. I forgot to mention before we start this that when I mic'd Deb, she didn't really have a good place to put the microphone, and so I put it on her sweater, and her sweater... It's kind of funny because she didn't have a pocket. She had kind of a dress on, and then she had a sweater, but the sweater had a hood. So there was no place to attach the wireless microphone, so I actually put the microphone, the body of it, the heavy part, in her hood. But then when I attached the microphone to her lapel, her hood started to fall down her back because of the weight, and so therefore the microphone came up to her shoulder, and you're going to be hearing some tinkling every once in a while, and that is her earring hitting the microphone. So lesson learned on miking people, and also I'm going to try to edit out and reduce that as much as possible, but I just wanted to apologize and let you know there's nothing wrong with your iPod, iPhone, your computer. It was all my fault, so I apologize. Here we go.
So Deb is an herbalist, a gardener, teacher, and author of the Woman's Handbook of Healing Herbs. Raised in a small town in western Maine, Deb began organic gardening and studying the medicinal uses of herbs at age 16, alongside internationally known medical herbalist Mary, is it Bove?
Bove.
Mm-hmm. Naming her after Jose Bove. In the fall of 1985, with her first mail order catalog and a small selection of herbal extracts and teas, Deb launched Avena Botanicals at the Common Ground Country Fair in Windsor, Maine. From April through October, Deb spends most days with her hands in the earth, tending 3 acres of medicinal plants using organic and biodynamic practices. First biodynamic certified farm in Maine, correct? During the spring and summer months, she teaches a variety of herb classes and offers bi-monthly herb walks. So schedules on these and on their website, in the Avena Botanicals Herb Gardens. Throughout the year, Deb writes herb articles, develops herbal remedies, and consults with clients and healthcare providers. So, and also she's got a new book coming out this winter.
This is very exciting. Hopefully May.
Really?
Coming out in May, yeah.
Wow, soon. Okay, so we'll have to bring you back on your book tour.
Thank
you very much for coming.
I know. I'm so glad I don't have to go very far from home. Just come to Belfast. It's great. Thank you. So I really want to thank Kate. She's been incredibly gracious to invite me to come. And also, we all know that we're really lucky to have you in this community and all the educational programs that you're devoted to. And also have a library like this. I mean, I think about how lucky this community is. We're really lucky to have public libraries. May they always be funded. Yes. Yes, they better be. So thank you all for coming. How many gardeners are here? Good. What a room full of gardeners. Great. And how many people growing any medicinal plants? Few people using medicinal herbs? Few people? I recognize some of you. Great. Well, I'll say a little bit. I wonder how many lights we can take down.
I always have to fiddle to see which is which. How about that one? And that one?
How's that for everybody? What, is that in your way?
That takes down all the ones on the page. Yeah, that's... Some people like to take notes. So is that a...
Is there any way...
So you want me to do... You can't do that.
Dark.
So that's the other option.
Dark. So we can see.
Follow them?
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Okay. Well, I was thinking, it was really fun for me tonight, given that we're officially in what... the early signs of spring. I mean, there's birds that are beginning to return, which is really, really wonderful. I always say to people, you know, why would you want to go away at this time of the year? It's amazing to watch the subtle, but very, it's really happening. You know, the beginning of spring is really happening. So it was really fun for me to be looking at all these images of plants because they're still tucked away in the ground at this point. So does anyone know what that flower is?
Calamari.
Yes, and it's native to here. It's edible, for those of you who might be interested in the edible aspect of flowers. It's also a very important flower for a number of different native pollinators. But I'll just say a couple things about my own background and about Avena. I did grow up in the western part of Maine in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. And I know I was thinking, almost 40 years ago is when I started my first vegetable garden. And I had read Diet for a Small Planet. And I was really, really wanted to begin growing my own vegetables, and that Frances Moore LePage's book inspired me. And then a year later, when I was 16, I was given my first herb book written by a wonderful herbalist, Juliette de Berkeley Levy, who just passed away at age 96 a few years ago. And she wrote many, many books, but her book, Common Herbs for Natural Health, was a book that was given to me almost 40 years ago and really started me on my way at starting to collect some of the wild edibles and starting to grow medicinal plants. And then I ended up at College of Atlantic here in Bar Harbor as one of the early graduates, and I just knew that I wanted to really dedicate my life to working with medicinal plants and helping people. And my interest in pollinators, I write this in my book that's about to come out. It's a book on gardening, and I honestly say, you know, I was really embarrassed that I had been gardening for close to 15 years, and I had never really thought about pollinators or birds. My grandmother was an amazing birder, and so I grew up around her, not so much learning the names of birds, but being aware of birds. But it really, you know, I'd been gardening quite a long time before I really recognized, wow, if we don't have pollinators, we won't have anything happening. And I was starting to save seeds at that point, and that's really what took me into my interest in really studying and observing different pollinators. So this is a corner of a Venus garden. We have almost 3 acres under cultivation, and we grow close to 100 different medicinal plants. But I also, as you'll see in tonight's presentation, there's a lot of medicinal plants, but there are also a number of flowers that, of course, that we can really create a diversity in our own gardens. And it really doesn't matter how big or small your garden is. So I love that our folks here are giving people a challenge to grow a 5x5 plot, because you can grow, you know, you can grow things in pots, you can grow small little areas, you can intersperse different plants in amongst, you know, just kind of where you're living. You're going to see me talk about dandelion, one of the most despised weeds that, you know, people spend in this country from 1990 to 2010. The increase in the amount of herbicides sprayed on just lawns is unbelievable for the sole purpose of getting rid of dandelions. Dandelions are one of the most important flowers for the hummingbirds when they return. If you can't hear, you can come up also. There's more seats up here. Anybody can't hear. So I don't know if Belfast has done what Camden and Rockport has done, but municipally, they no longer spray herbicides on the lawns of public areas in Rockport and Camden. Has Belfast done that yet?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, great challenge for you all here in Belfast. For your parks, for anything that's of public, you know, of public use, that's just a basic common thing, I think, that all communities should start doing. Particularly when I start talking about dandelion. I mean, I could talk all night about dandelion. Its health benefits, its edible benefits, but also it's one of the first flowers that the ruby-throated hummingbirds and the honeybees go for. So anyway, that's just one corner of the garden. And as Kate said, I have a real passion for education. I feel like if we're going to make any change in the world, it's going to be through education. And so that's the entrance to our garden, where we have lots of information for people, and it's like a little kiosk, and where we have a garden map for people to come and give themselves a self-guided tour, go on a tour. Again, just as an opportunity to learn about different types of plants. And I'm also on an old farm where there's a lot of different trees. I landed in a very beautiful farm. And Heather actually, who's right there, I'll embarrass her, but Heather actually was the person who designed the first part of the garden with me. So it's grown, and we've worked with the trees, and we work with the landscape, and I think wherever you live, you know, no matter how small or big it is, you can certainly start with what you have and create a habitat for pollinators. So just a few things I wanted to say about pollinators. Obviously, you're all interested in some way, but we know that pollinated insects are hugely important. We have over 250,000 species of flowering plants around this planet, and 90% of them are pollinated by insects. And as it says here, 1/3 of those crops are human crops. And that's why there's so much fuss right now, or in the last 5 to 7 years, about the honeybees, particularly out in the West Coast. I don't know if any of you follow, my partner grabs me things off the New York Times, the science section. There was another piece last week about the honeybees and the collapse that's happening. And right now the scientists are really leading it towards the classification of pesticides called the neonicotinoids. And that's something that if any of you want to continue to write letters to your congresspeople, you could say it's absolutely necessary that we really look to get rid of that whole classification of pesticides, and that we again begin helping people think differently about how we're working or not working, you know, with killing the insects. So our food crops, you know, particularly obviously the almond crop is one example, but the other thing to say, I think it's kind of obvious to everybody, is that there's a difference between the commercialization of honeybees and people having a few hives in their backyard. And the amount of stress that the honeybees are under obviously is contributing to their demise. So the other thing that I wrote here, which is that pollinators are so important, because we're not just talking about these beautiful pollinators, we're talking about a whole ecosystem. And so as I said here, you know, they're really important for all the plants that pollinators are connected to helping to prevent soil erosion, and then of course just supporting the life of everything that goes on in an ecosystem. And then the last, the economic value of insect pollinated crops, the last statistic that I could find was back from 2000, but over $20 billion worth of crops come out of, you know, the U.S. that are connected to pollination. So There is a financial, obviously, component to pollinators, which we most of us know that when there's an economic component, maybe there'll be a little bit of change that will start to happen. Let's hope so. So again, just little reminders to people, there's a monarch butterfly. They're also really struggling right now. Anybody's been following the monarch butterfly? When they didn't know where the monarchs wintered until the late 70s, anybody follow that story? The National Geographic, you know, was the, some of those people were who found where the monarchs winter, and it's gone. They've now decreased from, I think it was over 30 acres to 2.9 acres where the monarchs are left. It's a very, very complicated issue. If anybody's really interested, it's a beautiful book written called Four Wings and a Prayer. It was written by a journalist, and it's about the monarch butterflies. It's a really, really well-written book. But anyway, so it says 99% of our pollinators here in North America are insects, and we forget, but it's not just bees. You know, honeybees aren't even native to here, which I'll talk about, but beetles, flies, butterflies, moths. We only have the ruby-throated hummingbird here. It's the only hummingbird east of the Mississippi that breeds. There are a few, like they call it vagrant visitors of different species of hummingbirds, but we have the ruby-throated hummingbird here. And it is as effective as a pollinator as the honeybee, which is why I'm going to talk a lot about it. And then bats, of course. And as also, as I said, animals, our insects, are much more effective at transferring pollen for the pollination process than wind or water, even though wind and water are other factors. So people primarily think about honeybees, but as I said here, we have over 4,000 species of native bees in North America. So this is also why, you know, the creation of as much diversity as we can amongst plant life that will support these 4,000 species is really, really key. As I also said here, 3/4 of those species are solitary nesting in the ground bees. So that's also another whole piece that we can talk a little bit about. But the native bees are really, really important. And I think most of us recognize, but the loss and fragmentation of habitat is huge. And it, of course, what do we do in this country? We just go in and we build huge parking lots and huge malls and things like that. And we are definitely destroying habitat. And then whatever we have left is already being degraded. And then, of course, pesticide poisoning is pretty much, at this point, the number one reason why pollinators are really suffering. So these are all things that we all can do in our communities as individuals. One, of course, it's, you know, avoiding the use of poisonous chemicals. And I did want to say here that two people that have been really on my mind today as I've been thinking about this talk, I woke up thinking about the late Russell Libby, which most people know, who passed away in December, who was a director of MOFCA for 18 years. And he was incredibly dedicated to helping small farms and helping people not use poisonous chemicals. And if you read his last address that was printed in the September issue of the MOFCA paper, I reread it today, he was talking about Rachel Carson. And it's just amazing to me how many people never read Silent Spring. I decided I'm going to get my old book back out again. It came out 51 years ago. And I just think every high school, it should be required reading. So if any of you who are in school systems, make sure your students get to read Silent Spring. Sure, she's turning in her grave right now. Yes?
A couple of years ago, I read another book, and I don't remember who wrote it, but it was called Since Silent Spring.
Yeah, Since Silent Spring. Yeah. They're not easy books, but helpful for us to be educating ourselves. The other thing about growing a diversity of native plants, is particularly from starting in, you know, late April all the way into October, is that there's different migration patterns that are happening, particularly among the hummingbirds and different butterflies. So if you can, when you're designing your garden, think about educating yourself of what starts to bloom early, like the dandelions are one of our first native and one of our first wild flowers, all the way into October. That's really, really important for pollinators, that there's always something continuously blooming. And then, as I said, allowing for sheltered, undisturbed places for hibernation and overwintering of our ground nesting bees. And that can be as simple as you just leave a brush pile permanently in your yard, even if your yard is little. Or you designate kind of an area where you're just not going to do anything, but let it just naturally do what it does so that the ground nesting bees aren't disturbed. And I said, you know, bee nesting boxes certainly are something that people can have, but I am such a fan of encouraging people to keep their lawns that they mow to a minimum, enough for playing and hanging out on, and let things like clover and violets and dandelions and, you know, have kind of basically let part of your lawns just be wildflowers, you know, and really, that will really be of great benefit to pollinators. So I wanted to focus on the ruby-throated hummingbird and also on a number of different medicinal plants and flowers that in general are helpful for kind of a whole range of bees. But I will admit that the ruby-throated hummingbird is my favorite pollinator. I think it's an amazing, amazing bird. And I'm sure everybody here knows the ruby-throated hummingbird. Mm-hmm. Yes? Okay. So they winter in the ones that come up the East Coast. And I looked just the other day. You can, now that we have this internet, we can look to see all kinds of things. And there are people following the corridor that the ruby-throated hummingbird is migrating. And as of March 26th, there was a sighting of a ruby-throated hummingbird in Chesapeake Bay. But for us here, what I've noticed over the last several years is the male ruby-throated hummingbirds arrive where I am about between May 1st and May 15th. Anybody else kind of been watching, noting? So it's usually the first 2 weeks. The males come first and begin to set their territory, and then the females will come a little bit after the males. And I'll just say what's really interesting about the ruby-throated hummingbird is that the females and the males have nothing to do with each other except for to mate. And the males have that aggressive behavior because they're setting a territory, and the female chooses her mate based on the aggressive qualities of the male. Because then what happens, they mate, and that's the end of any relationship. The male has nothing to do with helping to feed babies. But what he does do is she'll build her nest. She does it completely by herself. Ruby-throated hummingbird nests are almost impossible to see. I love it. Has anybody seen one here? Mm-hmm. All right. A few of you. Good eyes. They're tiny. They might be like 2 inches long by about one and a half inches across. And they use like milkweed down, and they use different types of lichen, and they use spider webs to kind of weave it all together. They're tiny. And they, what you read in books, I don't know, I'd be curious what those of you who've seen the ruby-throated hummingbird nest, they say that they love to be near a water, and they'll kind of choose branches that kind of have a little bit of a fork in them and a little bending down. So you have to keep your eyes open. I've only seen hummingbird nests when I was in Costa Rica on a hummingbird project, because that's where most of the hummingbirds from New England, they go to Costa Rica to winter. And that's what's amazing is they make that, they kind of come down the coast and they come down across, you know, the southern part of the U.S. and then they make that 500-mile trip in one shot across the Gulf of Mexico. So that's why it's really important we talk about some of the flowers for the hummingbird, that particularly in May and then again in September when they're migrating, they weigh about 3.5 grams, the little ruby-throated hummingbirds, and they gain twice as much weight to make that migration. So it's pretty amazing. And of course, they have that beautiful little forked tongue that's amazing. They're the only bird that we know that can fly up and down and backwards. they're pretty fascinating. So there's one right there. It's not my photo. The other ones are photos of mine, but I love that one. That is actually the trumpet creeper, which we can grow here. And anybody growing trumpet creeper? This is a great example of also not necessarily growing out, but growing up. And the trumpet creeper is a native to the Northeast, and it's a vine, so it's a woody vine that grows up. So if you even have a simple way to grow, you know, some vines upward, the hummingbirds will appreciate the trumpet creeper. And then, as I said here, we think of them as, you know, going for all kinds of nectar, but in fact, they go for all kinds of little tiny spiders and gnats and things like that. And that's why I say to people, if you can really just let your neighborhood know to try to not go to their local, whatever, hardware stores and buy little cans of sprays that kill spider webs that live up and that make up, you know, people's corners of their houses and things like that. The hummingbirds really need all those little tiny spiders and insects to eat. So that's another reason to kind of, if we can, let some of those spider webs exist for one of their food sources. So here's a dandelion. Dandelion, yes?
But first of all, to hummingbirds or
our birds.
Well, the ruby-throated hummingbirds.
They need insects to feed their babies.
Yes.
This is so important.
Yes.
To allow them to eat.
Yes, and that's true of not just the ruby-throated hummingbird. Many, many birds are insect eaters. And so if we can really help people not to be, as you said, not to be spraying spider webs and things like that on, you know, places in people's houses, but to let them just be. I mean, we are very fortunate here. We don't have poisonous spiders. I mean, I've heard rumors every now and again, but, you know, for the most part, we're very safe here. And there's no reason to be killing them. So the dandelion, as I said, is one of the most despised weeds that I know of, probably throughout United States, and it is one of the most important flowers that we have for both the ruby-throated hummingbird and for a variety of bees, the honeybee and some of our native bees. So probably many of you have paid attention, you know, to your lawns, and if you haven't, you can think about that, because pretty soon I actually saw a few dandelions today outside. Anybody else seen any dandelions? I kind of right outside my little hoop house where we're starting seeds right now. I think it's because it's in a kind of a protected place. I was like, oh, there's dandelions. So, you know, besides being so incredibly deliciously edible for us, you know, probably many of you have eaten dandelion greens or one of our best spring tonic greens, wonderful in salads, wonderful in soups. The root is, from the herbalist perspective, is one of the most beneficial liver tonic herbs that we have to make into tea or tinctures to support the health of the liver. And the dandelion flowers are also edible for us, but the point I'm making is that they're extremely important for a number of different bees and the ruby-throated hummingbird. And this is the only time I say to people, I'm not a fan of hummingbird feeders, but it's the only time I might say to somebody, you know, when they're migrating north, they're so hungry that you might consider, you know, putting out a sugar water feeder, and then if you can, have lots of things for them, and then maybe put it up again when they're migrating south, because they get their energy from sugar. So the nectar is what they get their energy from. And then the Solomon seal. Is anybody growing Solomon seal? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a very, very important medicinal plant. It's native here. I mean, there's a lot of different species, but the Polygonatum biflorum is one of the species here that people grow. And you see it because New England has a lot of old farms and old farmhouses, you often see the Solomon seal around old stone walls and old farmhouses. And this is one that in my garden we grow in part sun and part shade. I'm kind of on a mission right now to really be trying to get more people to be growing Solomon seal, because the root is such a very, very valuable medicinal plant, both making it into an oil topically, but also making it into a tea or a tincture for helping with various types of musculoskeletal inflammation and injury. So tendonitis, bursitis, carpal tunnel, if somebody has broken a bone or really sprained or strained muscles, tendons, ligaments, Solomon seal is very, very important for the healing process. But the flower, which if you've paid attention, comes out in mid-May, it comes out just in time for the ruby-throated hummingbird. So this is a really interesting one. I love this about being able to spend 10 hours a day in my garden, because I love watching the interaction between pollinators. And you'll see that the Solomon seal also, there's a number of native bees that really appreciate Solomon seal. And you'll start to see hummingbirds and bees being a little competitive with each other. It's very, very fun to watch. And of course, hummingbirds can be quite aggressive. But bees will stand their ground also, because they're all hungry looking for nectar. So I just want to encourage people to consider this as a really important native plant. You know, it can grow totally, it's considered to be a woodland plant, but this far north, it can take some sun, some shade. And just if you do nothing but grow it for the pollinators, it's a very, very important one. And then bee balms. A lot of people grow bee balm. We have two native species of bee balm, the pink one, which is the Fistulosa. You'll see I've given you the common name and then the Latin name in parentheses. And then the red bee balm, the Didyma, and there are variations of the red bee balm. Both of them are very, very valuable for both the hummingbirds and for lots of different bees. And the bee balms, in my experience, the pink ones particularly, they reseed a lot in my garden. So if you were to get, like if you come to the plant sale, our friends have lots of beautiful bee balms. The folks that are selling at Rebel Hill Farm, they're wonderful people at the Co-op in Avena. The red bee balm, I I haven't seen it recede in the way that I have the pink. The pink just tends to recede a lot in my garden. And the red ones seem to just kind of stay more wherever they get planted. But both of them are beautiful. Both of them have been used by Native people for a long time for making into teas. And so you can make you can use the flower and the leaf as a fresh tea, or you can dry the flowers and leaves and then have it for a wintertime tea. It'd be a great one for you. They're perfect. They have a real pungent quality. So for coughs and colds and fevers, the bee balms can be really, really helpful. I also say to people, it's lovely to have, to dry different medicinal flowers and then put them in teas in the winter, making yourself a whole flower tea. So the bee balms, not so much all the variations of the cultivars. There's a lot of different cultivars now, but I'm really talking about the native purple and the native red ones are really beautiful. And then this one, does anybody grow this one? Anybody know this bee balm? This is an annual. Yeah, Heather grows this one. It's lemon bergamot, and Fedco Seeds sells it. I think Johnny's probably sells it. Horizon Herb Seed Company, who I get a lot of medicinal herb seeds from, they're out in Oregon. They sell this. Turtle Tree, which is a biodynamic seed company, they sell this. It's a very beautiful, unusual annual bee balm, and it's also used for tea. You can dry it, but it's also beautiful in flower arrangements. If you come to Avena's garden, you'll see I tend to grow it kind of in mass. It's just a very, very beautiful, unusual flower, and again, one that both the bees and the hummingbirds love. And you can also, when you look at the bee balms, like a lot of other tubular-like flowers, it's very obvious that those tubular flowers, in particular, the hummingbirds really love to get that little proboscis right into. And the evening primrose, one of our native wildflowers, and I'm also really trying to encourage people to learn what it looks like in the first year. This is a biennial. So the evening primrose, the first year will send up a rosette. Do people know this wildflower? A lot of people? Well, if you come to Vena, you can ask me and I can show you, because I do pull them up and put them in the compost, but I also leave quite a few to develop for the second year. So the evening primrose flowers, obviously, in the second year, and then it will reseed itself. So that's why if you start to get a few growing, you'll have it reseeding itself in quite abundance. But if it blooms, it's really, really fragrant in the evening. That's why it got its name, evening primrose. And this is one that will be fragrant a lot through the night and into the early morning. And this is one of the first flowers, like at 5 in the morning, that's still fragrant that the hummingbirds will come to. So this is a really nice one to consider leaving in your garden. And I did an experiment years ago. I like sleeping in my garden a lot in the summer. And there was an area where there were a bunch of evening primroses. So I said, okay, I want to know what time hummingbirds get up in the morning. I'm definitely a closeted scientist. So I took my little clock out there with me. This is for the month of August. I slept out every night. This is years ago. And the light, shifts a little bit in August. But basically at 5 in the morning, the hummingbirds are right there going for the evening primroses. So it's a beautiful, beautiful plant. It's also the flowers edible. The root of the first year, they say, is edible. I haven't ventured there. It's really the flower that I love to put in either a salad or to have it a little bit of a tea. And then this one, I gave you really close up of this. But this is a really beautiful foxglove to consider growing. Foxgloves also are biennials. It's called Grecian foxglove. Digitalis lanata is the Latin of it. So a lot of us are really familiar with the beautiful purple foxgloves. We always say they're like little fairy caps. They are, you don't want to have them around for small children because the leaves can be a little bit toxic or very toxic. But once your children are grown enough to know what not to eat in the garden, foxgloves are beautiful to put in. But in particular, this particular species, the Grecian foxglove, the hummingbirds love. And once you also have it growing in the garden, it will begin to reseed. And I always say to my students, you will pass your exam if you can identify what plants look like when they first come up. So that's a good, I think any good gardener knows that you want to recognize who's what when they're coming up, because I don't necessarily want to just be pulling up anybody. And particularly the Grecian foxglove is a very, unusual looking rosette when it first appears. It's kind of got long lance-like leaves, and you really want to be able to know what it looks like so that you can, basically when it starts to reseed, you can either dig them up and move them around or know what they are. But it is stunning, and it will grow, it will grow tall like the other foxgloves if it's happy where it is. So it's a quite spectacular. And then this also, this is a very old-fashioned European herb that a lot of people are beginning to be more interested in. Clary sage? Anybody growing clary sage? Yeah, a beautiful, beautiful, again, a biennial. Here we are back to, it's a salvia. It's in the mint family. So it's all, there's so many different types of salvias. But this one, clary sage, again, you can see that beautiful flower, mint-type flower that both the honeybees, but particularly the ruby-throated hummingbird, really, really loves this one. And again, this is it, the rosette, when it first comes up, it's like they're kind of roundish leaves. They're a little bit rough to touch, and it's a beautiful rosette that they can get to be quite big, actually, if they're happy where they show up. And they'll start to reseed once you have planted them. And beautiful, beautiful fragrance. Are they purple?
Edible.
You probably could eat them. It's in the mint family. It's safe to say that most mint family plants, the flowers are edible. I mean, I think because I kind of feel like I'm in competition with the hummingbirds, I probably leave it for them, but you probably definitely could nibble on a few, yeah, of them. And this one also is striking. It can grow to be quite tall. So it's a beautiful one to consider. And I also was thinking about I think as I've gotten older and I recognize, I have to conserve my energy here a little bit, I'm fascinated by plants that reseed. Let them do the work for us. Mm-hmm. Really let them do the work and pass around the things that, we need to pass around if we, aren't starting things from seed. So another one that will reseed. And then this is kind of one of the most common honeysuckles that you see probably it vines up and people grow them over arbors and probably Heather knows the species it is. I forget the species. Yes, it is. I'll have to change it. So I love this one. It grows up. I purposely grow it on my deck where I sit in the evening. And the hummingbirds, I have this deck where I plant it, surround it with all kinds of flowers that the hummingbirds love. So I can sit there at dusk and watch them. I just sit there and then they come up and they're feeding on the honeysuckles and they're feeding on lots of other things. So that's a fun thing to do too if you have a sitting area, is to plant it full of things where the hummingbirds will come to. And then this is another one that I really encourage people to grow. It's called the hummingbird sage. It's native to the Southwest, so New Mexico, Arizona, that part of the world. It grows here as an annual. Salvia coccinea is the Latin of it. And we started in our greenhouse towards the end of April, and I planted out early June, and I start about 300 of them. And there's Johnny sells a variety of it, and I'm kind of on a mission right now because I really like the deeper red. Johnny's is a little bit more of a, more of a pinky color, and I like the deeper red. But anyway,
this isn't the same as the red gentian sage.
No, it's different. Okay. Yeah, good question though. This one will grow. Will start to bloom kind of late June, early July, and it will bloom all the way into October till it's a really major killing frost. And that's why I really encourage people to grow this, because the hummingbirds really need that food, in October or September when they're migrating. And it's beautiful to just kind of mass this in. And this one you could even grow in pots for people who are looking for pots. But it's a beautiful one. And here it's an annual. And then there's a beautiful red zinnia. Again, hummingbirds love zinnias, as do bees. And then this one is a major, major one for many different types of pollinators. This is the Mexican sunflower, Tithonia rotundifolia. Most seed companies sell Mexican sunflower seeds. It's easy to start from seed. I've learned as I've gotten older that a lot of the annuals, I don't start them until usually the third week of April. When you think about it, they're going to get too leggy, because really we don't start to put annuals out until early June, really until that last frost, whether it's, mid to late May, or even possibly sometimes we might have a full moon as early June. So all the annual flowers that I'm talking about, I don't tend to put them out until the first and second week of June. So the Mexican sunflower, is anybody growing Mexican sunflower? That's the one plant that you go away with tonight. Think about growing this. They'll grow to be this tall. They love to grow in compost. And I also say one of the things that you will find that's of great benefit to the pollinators, if you are growing things in hedgerows or en masse. Like I said, I grow 300 mix of the hummingbird sage, and I actually grow about 300 Mexican sunflowers. And if you come to Avena, when you come down the driveway, on the left-hand side of the driveway in front of our hoop house, we always do a massive hedgerow of Mexican sunflowers. Mm-hmm. And they're amazing. They're like velvet when they first start to, the leaves and the stalk of the plant is like velvet. And then they usually don't start to flower until kind of mid-July, but this is a major, major pollinating flower for all of our native bees, you know, tons of different types of bumblebees that we have, and the honeybee, and the monarch butterfly, and the ruby-throated hummingbird. I mean, basically, this is like a one-stop for so many of our wonderful pollinators here. So growing hedgerows of something like the Mexican sunflower really helps them because they, particularly ruby-throated hummingbirds and honeybees, are very species specific. They really appreciate going from the same species to the same species. So if you create a mass of one particular species of a flower that they appreciate, you're really helping them a lot with their work. So this is a very, very fun hedgerow to watch, particularly the monarch and the hummingbirds. Like I was describing hummingbirds and bees, the same thing will happen. The monarch will flap their wings quite aggressively when the hummingbirds come close. It's very fun to watch them interacting with each other. So again, if this is some, it's pretty fun to plant them near your house where you might be sitting, if you really want to watch the activity that's going on. This one also, if you keep deadheading your flowers, they will just keep producing flower after flower after flower up until we have a killing frost. So again, most seed companies now, I know Johnny sells it and Fedco sells it, and it's a very important pollinating flower, really beautiful one. And then the little lungwort, one of our European perennials that is a lot of people grow here. Anybody growing lungwort? Yeah, beautiful speckled leaves. The flowers are one of our first flowers. They start to flower by mid-May. This is one of the first flowers that the ruby-throated hummingbird also appreciates. So dandelion, Solomon seal, and lungwort. Three really important of our early spring flowers for the hummingbirds. And just a beautiful, delightful little, you know, plant to grow underneath. Like I have some growing underneath one of my magnolia trees, and they love to kind of just, and they'll spread, you know, they'll start to seed themselves. So one to consider growing underneath things. And I threw the larkspur in because a lot of people love to grow larkspur because it's so beautiful as a cut flower. Anybody grow larkspur here? But yeah, and there's different colors of them. But I just threw that in because I've also been watching that the hummingbirds really appreciate the larkspur. So if you're looking for growing some cutting flowers, the Mexican sunflower is one actually you can cut, but the larkspur is another one that you can cut and bring in. This is a really significant medicinal herb for us. The marshmallow, it's Althea officinalis is the Latin name, and it grows to be 5 to 6 feet tall. It's a hardy, hardy perennial here in Maine. It will begin to reseed itself. So it's one you want to keep an eye on, knowing what it looks like when it first comes up. But it has these very soft, velvety leaves and this very, very sweet, delicate little flower that looks like it's in the mallow family. It's kind of a tiny little version of a hollyhock flower. These flowers are edible to us. And the leaf we can make tea from. And the root is also very, very medicinal for all kinds of respiratory conditions. So both the flower and the root can be made into, can be dried for teas, for soothing an irritated cough, or also tissue that in some ways become irritated by smoke. If somebody's been exposed to smoke or various types of not so healthy chemicals people have been around and has irritated the lung tissue. Marshmallow is very, very helpful for healing lung tissue. But the marshmallow, even if you just grew one plant, it's very beautiful to grow. But again, they grow. It's nice to grow it in a hedgerow. And right at kind of one of the entrances to our garden, we have a hedgerow of this growing. This is the plant that really we have a picnic table near the marshmallow hedgerow. And so one day I was just sitting there eating my lunch and I was watching, and I didn't know the hummingbirds liked marshmallow, and that was just because I happened to be sitting there watching, and I was just like, oh my gosh, look at that. They really love the marshmallow. And so year after year, they come to enjoy the nectar from the marshmallow. But this is also where I began to recognize, you know, there's so much myth about hummingbirds really appreciating red-colored flowers? Completely false. You know, white Solomon seal flowers, the kind of pinky lungwort, the yellow dandelion, and the white marshmallow. So this is a beautiful one to consider, definitely to consider growing. And it will also grow where it's a little bit damp. So if you have a little bit of a damp area, marshmallow will grow there. So this is an old, actually, photograph of my garden at the entrance, but those white flowers are absolutely stunning. It's a jasmine-scented nicotiana. Anybody grow jasmine-scented nicotiana? I love this flower. And again, like the evening primrose, the jasmine-scented nicotiana is scented in the evening. And so it's one of the last flowers that the hummingbirds will go to. And if you keep nipping it off, I mean, you can bring them into bouquets, but if you keep, again, nipping off, you know, the spent flowers, it'll just keep producing flowers after flowers. It's a beautiful one if you have a garden near an open window, because that, you know, the fragrance of this particular flower will come in. But this is also a favorite of the ruby-throated hummingbird. And then you're going to see sunflowers to the left there. And I've always really scratched my head about why has the industry decided to breed sunflowers that have no pollen. It's ridiculous. Because what? They don't like having pollen on their table, probably, right? When they bring in, because sunflowers make beautiful, I'm being a little bit judgmental here, sorry about that. But, you know, sunflowers are beautiful in bouquets. And sunflowers are a major source of pollen and nectar for a variety of bees. So if you're one who loves to grow sunflowers for the bees, make sure that you're reading the description in the flower catalogs, because there are definitely more and more pollenless sunflowers than there ever were before. So again, sunflowers are so fabulous because, as we know, you know, they're beautiful, they grow up. I love their heart-shaped leaves, and you'll have many, many happy bees. And then, of course, beautiful, beautiful cut flowers. So again, like the Mexican sunflower, it's beautiful to consider a lot of our different sunflowers to grow them in a hedgerow so that you have a lot of them in a grouping and different types of them if you are one who likes different varieties of them. Fedco sells so many different varieties. And then Johnny's, of course, with all their colored photographs, you can see all their colored possibility of sunflowers that you can have. And sunflowers, in my experience, really do appreciate a little extra compost. They're quite heavy feeders. And now, of course, we're seeing more sunflower seed projects here in Maine, starting to grow sunflowers for seed that's edible and also for pressing into oil. I think some of you might have did a demonstration at the fair, so that's going to be hopefully happening more. And then in the back, you're seeing the pink Echinacea purpurea flowers, the purple cone flowers, which I think many, many people grow. I say that the Echinacea is like kind of a bridge plant, because it's, you know, it's really used kind of in the ornamental flower world because it's such a beautiful, long-lasting perennial flower. But it's also a really significant perennial, because the monarch butterflies really love the Echinacea. A variety of our native bees really like and really, really like the Echinacea. So consider also, if you're going to, you know, grow some Echinacea, grow a nice grouping of it, not just one or two, but, you know, grow a nice bed of it. So the honeybee, just as a reminder, it's not native to us here. It's native to Europe and Asia. And, you know, it came a long time ago with the European settlers. And, of course, it's, you know, throughout North America. And I always quiz people. You can see what I said here, that the commercially managed honeybee colonies started to decline in the 1940s, and they've been declining since the 1940s. What happened in the 1940s? But why pesticides? What was happening in the 40s? World War II. So World War I and World War II, the leftover ammunition, they had to do something with it, and that was the beginning of pesticides. So it's very, that statistic when I saw that was really interesting to me, to, you know, to really chart, to note the beginning, you know, post-World War II and the beginning of the massive, you know, production of pesticides. So it's, you know, it's only been a really such a short time, you know, 60, 70, 80 years. I mean, Rudolf Steiner, who was the founder of biodynamic agriculture, which we practice a lot of different biodynamic techniques in our gardens, you know, he was writing I think even before 1920, he wrote a whole honeybee lecture. And he said that within 80 years, he predicted, this was in like around 1920, he predicted that within 80 years we would see the honeybees really, really suffering. And that was, you know, he predicted that long, long, long time ago, and he was accurate, actually. So, yeah, it's a little bit sobering. May it turn around. So if I put that in there just in case nobody had ever seen a swarm. That was at Avena many, many years ago up in the oak tree. That's what a honeybee swarm looks like. It's pretty amazing, actually, to see a swarm. So this is actually, I wanted to put in some of the medicinal plants that honeybees appreciate and a number of our native bees. This is a black cohosh. I don't think you can probably see it very well. Black cohosh flowers. Black cohosh is native. It's one of our woodland native plants. They'll grow, if you come to Avena in July, the flowers grow about this tall. It's a tall raceme-like flower stalk covered with these beautiful, beautiful white flowers. You can see, I put this in because you can see the white pollen on the honeybee. Can you see? On its little leg there, it's got some white pollen. And black cohosh will be covered when it starts to flower. It's covered with both a lot of different types of bumblebees and native bees. It's quite amazing. So I really encourage people who are interested in native plants to consider growing black cohosh. And in my garden, I have some growing in the woods. I've created a woodland area where there's black cohosh growing, but I also have it growing kind of in part sun, part shade. This far north, I think it can take a little bit of sun. It doesn't necessarily like full sun all day long. I mean, I have a few that get full sun, but it really likes kind of part sun, part shade, or even more shade. You'll see that the ones that get a little bit of sun will grow a little bit bigger, of course, than the ones just in the woodland garden because of the sun. But a very, very important native plant to consider. Very highly medicinal. It's at risk right now because it's being over-harvested in the wild. It's not native this far north. It's really more in southern Appalachia where black cohosh is native. That's where I first, in 1984, I spent a fall living up in the Appalachian Mountains, kind of near Burnsville, North Carolina. I was living in a Quaker community, and that's where I first was introduced to black cohosh. That's where I first saw it in the wild. It was beautiful to see it growing in its habitat. But this is a very important plant for people to consider growing in their gardens. And you're going to see more nurseries now are, you know, there's a little bit of a growing interest in native plants. And so this particular, it's Simisifuga racemosa is a species. You're also going to see some variations of this in the kind of in the ornamental industry, but the black cohosh, the Simisifuga racemosa is the one that you want. And it's hardy here, and it will grow for years and years and years. And make sure you just give it enough, you know, plant it with plenty of room because it will spread through its kind of the root activity. It will expand itself, and it appreciates having enough air circulation. But a very important one to grow, and that's what the top of the flowers look like. They're just beautiful, and they have a this is a really interesting flower because one of the draws that pollinators have to flowers is of course color and shape of flowers, but also smell. And black cohosh, some people say it smells like dirty socks. You'll never forget that. So it has and it's interesting because it will start to come out, and there's at a certain point where it becomes very smelly, and then it's just covered with bees. It's really amazing to watch that. And then, of course, this is also one of our native plants, the butterfly weed, Asclepias tuberosa. I'm going to talk a little bit about our native native Asclepias species. The butterfly weed used to be in Maine on its own. And I don't think I don't know of any patches of this plant that are left in Maine. Out in Minnesota, I hear from herbalists out there that it's flourishing out in Minnesota, but here we don't have it anymore. It's fortunately one that we can grow. Is anybody growing butterfly weed in their garden? Really, really nice one to grow. And has anybody had it reseed in your garden?
No,
me neither.
I really have to work at it.
I know. Well, it loves it. I know. I figured out that this is one that really likes it where it's hot, dry, and sunny. It doesn't like damp soil at all. So that's one thing. Whereas the swamp milkweed, I think I put in There's swamp milkweed. I love this. You can see. Can you see? I mean, this is, we're in the milkweed family here. It's really obvious. But the swamp milkweed Asclepias incarnata, it is native here. You can start it from seed. You can certainly buy seedlings. This one, of course, swamp, gives us a little bit of a clue that it likes it where it's more damp. I'm trying to establish this down by my, we have a little pond at Avena. But the orange one, all the milkweeds, obviously, pollinators appreciate. The orange one, if you have a drier, sunnier location, you'll be able to, you know, once you have it growing. But I will say that you can grow it from seed, which I've done many times. The tuber of the orange butterfly weed is what's used for medicine. But it's a very finicky. Like if you were to buy a butterfly weed, be very, very gentle when you transplant it, because it's just, you'll see this in most of the gardening books. They'll say it really doesn't like being disturbed. So just be extra careful when you go to transplant it. But this, it's really amazing, all three of them. And then this one, our common milkweed, you know, that pretty much everybody probably recognizes this one. And I some of my field we cut and some of our field we leave to the milkweed, because it's such a fantastic, of course, plant. And all of these species, all three of them, the butterfly weed, the swamp milkweed, and our common milkweed, who comes along and lays their eggs on the leaves? The monarch. So we need, you know, either if you don't have the common milkweed, or you can leave a patch of it growing, you know, that you're going to be, you'll hopefully begin to get on the monarch root. We had a really tremendous monarch butterfly year last year. Did other people notice that in their gardens? I hadn't for probably 8 years had that. There was just, I mean, well, there would be times I'd be standing and I could count like 12 or 15. And that's because, like, I had that long row of the tithonia, the Mexican sunflowers, and I could just see a lot of them all at once. And I hadn't counted numbers all in a group like that for years. So I was happy to see that. But the common milkweed, again, one of their primary, the leaves are one of their primary sources. The beautiful borage, probably some people grow borage, will reseed in your garden very, very easily. And it's also called bee bread sometimes, or you hear it sometimes called bee balm, but this is another bee-loving plant. The borage flowers are edible and very, 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 very beneficial to the bees. A lot of time people who have beehives, anybody, do we have any beekeepers here? A few beekeepers here, okay. Borage is definitely one that people tend to kind of like to cultivate around their hives. This is my favorite basil, sacred basil, originally from India, Osimum sanctum, Fedco cells, sacred basil seeds, Johnny sells sacred basil seeds, Horizon Herbs sells sacred basil seeds. I grow the variety that Fedco sells. It's a beautiful green color, and we started towards the latter part of April, and I plant it out in June, and it will go all the way to the frost. This particular basil is very, very medicinal. So it's very, you can make fresh tea from it, you can dry it for tea, you can make tincture from it. We put it in honey. It's an amazing, amazing flavor of this particular basil. But the honeybees in particular love this basil. And so again, I grow a huge bed of about 500 to 600 seedlings of sacred basil, because we use so much of it for medicine. But it's one that I tend to let it flower a little bit before I nip the tops. And everybody probably knows that, like your common basil that you're making pesto from, you keep nipping it and it will keep bushing out on you, and that's important to do, or else you'll just have your plant go to seed. So the same thing, I will be nipping. We tend to harvest our sacred basil sometimes twice a week, because they're just bushing and bushing and bushing. But the honeybees literally just cover it. And particularly in September, the honeybees are looking for other things. And the sacred basil is certainly one to consider, and a great one to grow in pots. So for those of you who are looking for things, you know, for your deck and pot, sacred basil is one to do that. There are 9 species of echinacea that are native to North America. Echinacea is more, it's originally, we know it as a prairie plant. So there are some species that are from the Dakotas down across into Oklahoma, across into Tennessee. There is one species of echinacea. Echinacea is the genus. And Tennesseeensis, Echinacea tennesseeensis, is the one echinacea that is on the federally endangered plant list, because it's lost its habitat and it's been way over harvested. So that particular species is at risk for being lost. This is Echinacea purpurea, obviously with a honeybee. This is the one that the species that we grow in our gardens. You'll see that particularly more science-oriented herbalists will fight over which species of Echinacea are most beneficial. And I kind of say it's not even an issue because you need to grow the Echinacea species that grow well where you live. And the Echinacea purpurea is the one that grows really, really well here, and that many, many people will harvest the fresh flowers and tincture them for medicine, that harvest the fresh leaves and tincture them. And then we wait until the plant is 3 years old. And in the fall of the third year, we dig the roots. And those roots you can either dry for tea or you can tincture them fresh. And a lot of people start using medicinal herbs through Echinacea. That's what I was saying. It's kind of like a bridge plant. So besides being very beautiful, being very effective for different bees and monarch butterflies, it's also very, very beneficial medicinally for all of us. Really helping to prevent early onset of colds, flus, and fevers, and helping to rebuild, helping to increase white blood cell count. But particularly, I mean, look how beautiful it is. I just think it's an amazing, amazing plant to grow. And then this is also one of our native flowers, the blue vervain. Anybody have blue vervain growing? Good, people. Once you, if you are looking for blue vervain, I know that our friends at Rebel Hill, they sell blue vervain plants. It's a beautiful plant to consider growing. It, one, it's native. Two, lots of different native bees love these flowers. They're an unusual blue. They start to bloom where we are kind of late July, early August, and they tend to bloom through August, so it's kind of nice to have an August blooming flower. They can grow up to be, I don't know, I mean, I think I have some maybe that grow this tall in my garden. And it was interesting when I was first learning about growing this plant, you'll see mostly the books will say it needs to grow where it's damp and part shade. Well, that completely went out the window in my garden because they reseed themselves wherever they want to be. So they're growing sometimes in dry places, in full sun, sometimes in damp areas. So you can play around with blue vervain, but once you have a few plants and you begin to let it go to seed, you'll begin to, you'll begin to have it around your garden, and various bees will be very, very happy. It's also very medicinal. It's bitter. It's one of the most beneficial herbs that I know of for the nervous system, for people who are under a lot of stress, particularly who hold a lot of stress in their neck. And I often say, especially for women who tend to get really kind of grumpy before their periods, or women going through menopause, a little bit irritable, this is a great plant. It's a really beautiful one to consider for the pollinators and for us. And then this is the only picture I have, but I wanted to talk about linden. Linden trees are fabulous for the bees. And has anybody ever stood under a linden tree when it's flowering? Oh my gosh, what do you hear? Thousands of bees, particularly the honeybees, they love the linden flowers. So Fedco Trees sells the American linden, and I think probably more nurseries are starting to sell linden trees. In the nursery tray, they certainly sell Tilia cordata. It's a little bit of a smaller one, but the American linden or the basswood, you know, it's native here. You can certainly grow it, and if you're growing it, I mean, what I found is that the deer nibble at them when they're young. So I put my linden trees and, you know, I put cages around them up, you know, the cages are about this tall so that they can really establish themselves well so the deer won't destroy them. And after it probably will take 8 to 10 years before you'll really start to get a lot of flowers. But linden flowers are so important. So, you know, even just one linden tree or two linden trees you might have for the bees, but also for yourself. And European herbalists use linden a lot more than the American herbalists, but linden flower and leaf tea is very sweet tasting. Has anybody ever had linden tea? Yeah, and very, very, very beneficial for the nervous system, so very calming to stress, and also for people who may have a little bit of elevated blood pressure. Linden is known to be very, very helpful at helping to lower blood pressure, or helping people who maybe have cardiovascular disease in their family to use linden flower as a tea. It's wonderful. So I'm hoping more people will be buying linden trees and planting them because they're so wonderful. And then the hawthorn too. And the hawthorn If you come to visit us at Avena, we have 50 hawthorn trees that surround our first garden that Heather designed. Now they're like 15, 16 feet tall. I put them in 97. And I have these pictures of us. You know, they're little, just one.
Twigs.
Yeah, little twigs. Thank you. Twigs from FEDCO. And now we have these amazing hawthorn trees that, like the linden, when they're flowering, they are covered with honeybees, literally. I mean, I can just stand there and listen to them. Hawthorn is a wonderful one to grow as a hedgerow, particularly if you're looking for a living fence, because I planted them close enough so they just fill themselves in. Every now and then I'll get a deer that will kind of sneak in through there, but they can really be helpful as a deer fence. It takes like 10 years, but they're wonderful. And then the hawthorn flowers can be gathered and dried for tea, or you can make a tincture from them. They're probably the most famous cardiovascular tonic herb that we have for helping to support the health of the cardiovascular system. And then they have these beautiful red berries. So the berries are, we gather the berries in October. And the berries are a little bit astringent. So you can certainly dry them for tea. They're not yummy like rosehips, where you might be making rosehip jam. They wouldn't really taste good in that way. I did one year kind of cook them with some apples and made apple, kind of canned applesauce with a little bit of a hawthorn berry flavor to them. And it was okay, but nothing I would probably repeat. It would be more like making a hawthorn berry syrup, you know, cooking lots and lots of hawthorn berries down for a long time and making like a syrup that you might sweeten with a little bit of honey in that way. But hawthorn, again, even just one or two trees, we have hawthorn. I will just say there are lots of different species. They all can be used pretty interchangeably, but the white flowering one is the one primarily the herbalists will use for medicine. But again, linden trees and hawthorn trees, really valuable to have. And then the hyssop, again, one of our hardy woody perennials. The blue one is a beautiful color to grow. Very bitter, very pungent, very helpful for respiratory, for coughs and infections in the winter. But again, hyssop is a beautiful blue that blooms kind of late July in our garden. And the bees, of all different types of bees, really, really love hyssop and lavender. Probably a lot of people know lavender. Juliette Duberkley-Levy, who I mentioned, who was my first herb teacher from Europe, she used to say to me, really look to, you know, again, she was born and raised in England, and her orientation was towards more the Mediterranean herbs. But she always said to me, you know, lavender, people completely overlook it as a bee plant. And she was right. I mean, I really started to watch lavender. Actually, the first photograph in my book that's about to come out called How to Move Like a Gardener, the first photograph is one of a lavender with a bumblebee on it. So honeybees, bumblebees really will appreciate lavender and lemon balm. So a lot of people probably grow lemon balm also. We grow it for tea. It's wonderful to have as a cool tea in the summer. You can dry it for tea in the winter. It doesn't have nearly the strong lemony flavor as it does in the summer when you make a fresh tea from it in summer. But lemon balm also, it was really because of Juliette that I started to pay attention, because the flowers of a lemon balm are very tiny, but the bees really, really go for them. So if you have lemon balm growing, you know, maybe grow a small little area for lemon balm. You know, grow 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 plants if you want, and let some of them flower. You know, if you keep nipping off some of the leaves and making tea for yourself, but also let some of them go to flower for the bees. And for us, we do our first big lemon balm harvest in mid-June. Actually, before they flower, we harvest dozens of pounds that I make into tincture and a glycerin, and we make into a lemon balm salve for the lips. But I also dry some for tea. And then if you harvest in mid-June, you're going to get another really nice harvest in August. So again, you can just keep that in mind if you're looking to make some medicine from lemon balm. You know, grow a few. Now, I know people complain about lemon balm going to seed and like taking over in their garden. I've never seen that in my garden. Has anybody had lemon balm do that here? Oh, okay, we do. Where do you live?
Waldo
County. Comes in as somebody who has lemon balm reseeding all over her garden. That's great. So do you give it away?
What's that?
Do you give them away?
Do I give it away?
Your lemon balm plants. Or do you just keep
it, but maybe I should.
No, I'm just saying, you know, I hear people complaining. Like they say, oh, the lemon balm, it just takes over my garden. I say, well, just give them away. Give the plants away to your other friends, because it's such a wonderful, wonderful. I mean, you can start it from seed. certainly it's not difficult to start from seed. It's one of those light dependent seeds, so you just kind of tamp the seed into a little pot, and lemon balm is really easy to start from seed, but a beautiful one, and it is one of my favorite ones. Lemon balm is amazing because it has an affinity with the nervous system, so it's very, very helpful for stress, easing stress, particularly people who easily get overwhelmed. Lemon balm also has some antiviral properties, so it's very, very helpful for helping to prevent or helping to resolve more quickly a flu or a fever in the wintertime. Particularly, it's a really nice tasting herb for children or for older folks who are looking for something that might taste a little bit bitter to help prevent a flu. Lemon balm is a very, very effective plant. It's one that I would totally give to children who have been exposed to chicken pox. You know, chicken pox, you want them to get it. But lemon balm can help ease through that kind of time period of chicken pox. It's an amazing medicinal plant and really a good one to grow. You can see the honeybee and the nasturtium. If you come to visit us at Avena, you'll see we have little hedgerows of nasturtiums. I love to grow nasturtiums. I grow the jewel mix and I grow the Alaska mix, the variegated one. There, you know, nasturtium you can grow in pots, you can grow in hanging pots, and you will find that hummingbirds will come in nasturtium flowers and all kinds of bees, and they love just to come right inside that flower. And then, of course, nasturtium flowers are edible for us, and the leaves are edible. I say to people, you know, add them into your salads. It's a fantastic medicinal plant because it's pungent. You know, we all know how pungent that flower is when you eat it. Very, very, it gives a little bit of a support to the immune system. And then the other thing I wanted to say about nasturtiums is one of my favorite things to do is to go to the co-op, buy organic cream cheese, and then blend it in with a little bit of maple syrup and a little bit of vanilla and make little balls and stuff your nasturtium flowers. And it's like unbelievably delicious because you're getting like the sweetness of the cream cheese and the maple syrup, and you're getting the pungent quality of the flowers. It's a really sweet little treat to have. So think about if you have, you know, again, if you have a place to have a little bit of a hedgerow, the nasturtiums are really beautiful to grow along a pathway or a walkway or something like that. And I love this botanist. He said the most prudent approach to conservation of a locally rare plant would be to preserve and manage not solely the plant, but as many components of the ecosystem as possible. And this would likely include the pollinators, seed dispersers, and other organisms that perform important roles in the plant's life cycle. So again, it's just the reminder that nothing lives in isolation. Everything is connected. So this is that beautiful poppy that the honeybees absolutely love. And I've counted up to 6 or 7 honeybees in one flower at a time. They happen to love this poppy. And so the one that we have, this is kind of like more like a deep kind of maroonish purple one, but I've also seen people have them in pink colors. Anybody growing this poppy?
Yeah. Yeah. The old fashioned one.
Yeah.
Well, because like the house where I live, it's growing there when I moved there, you know, like 35 years ago.
Yeah, of course.
And it's like pink on the outside and purple on the inside.
Oh, wow.
But I've got a picture with the 6 bees in it.
Yes. It's an amazing one to grow. So this is a simple one for people just to scatter a few poppy seeds. Because once you have them, of course, like you know, they've just been reseeding themselves all these years. And I didn't plant it. Poppy just sort of showed up in my garden, which is sort of fun sometimes to watch who kind of shows up in the garden. And I just let them be because they're amazing for the bees. And of course, the poppies, they're so beautiful. They're just a beautiful, beautiful flower to have. And then this is, there's a honeybee, and this is a larger St. John's wort flower. We actually, and I learned this from Heather, and I got this seed actually from you, Heather. This is the St. John's wort that's one of our woody native St. John's wort, the Hypericum frondosum. And this, Heather actually used to work at Garden in the Woods in Framingham, Massachusetts. If you've never been there, it's a place worthy of going to. 40 acres of native woodland plants. And so this is actually has grown to be, it's a tall, woody shrubby. No one's done any research on it as far as the medicine properties, but certainly the honeybees love it. And it's a much bigger flower than our wild, you know, the wild St. John's wort that's naturalized itself here. Hypericum perforatum, the one we use for medicine, is not native to the U.S. It's native to Northern Europe. This one is actually native to us. We have a few species of Hypericum native. But again, this is if you wanted to grow a really interesting native woody St. John's wort. This is the one I would definitely recommend growing, the frondosum. It's a very, very fun one to grow. And then the time, all the different times, lots of different times, creeping times, garden times, all kinds of variations of times. They all are, the honeybees love all the different times that you can consider growing. And this is thanks to Heather. In the very center of our first garden, we put in a 20-foot diameter circle, and we planted it to over 100 creeping times with these beautiful stepping stones. And it tends to bloom kind of late June, early July, and it's just covered with honeybees. They love creeping thyme flowers. There it is, kind of in the early morning. You can see it will really fill out, and pretty soon I don't really have any stepping stones anymore. Yeah, it's beautiful. The anise hyssop, a beautiful licorice-tasting herb that will reseed in your garden. Also kind of a shorter-lived perennial, but that will keep reseeding in your garden. The flowers are edible. They make a really lovely tea if you like the taste of licorice, but also a favorite of different types of bees. And it's, again, nice to grow it kind of in a whole grouping like that, where it's beautiful. And if you keep nipping off those flowers, it will keep producing flowers. So it's another one to consider. And then the Greek mullein. If you come to my garden, I always say I'm happy to pass on Greek mullein seedlings, because Greek mullein will reseed in incredible abundance. The Greek mullein, which obviously is originally from the Mediterranean area, you can see that bumblebee with its pollen sac just covered with orange pollen. But the Greek mullein looks like this. It's just, it has dozens and dozens and dozens of stalks. A lot of people know the common mullein, which sends up one stalk. The Greek mullein, you will do such a favor to the pollinators if you consider growing Greek mullein. And I am happy to give away Greek mullein seedlings if you come to visit us. It's a biennial, so it will have a beautiful rosette the first year, like any mullein. And the second year, it sends up this flower stalk that literally has thousands of mullein flowers. You will have happy goldfinches. They will come in the fall, and they'll be hanging off from the dried mullein stalks and just eating the seeds. And here what we're doing is we're collecting the mullein flowers that we infuse in olive oil for earaches. Make a little mullein flower oil. The mullein flowers are also really helpful if you put it in like a glycerin base for people who have respiratory problems. But the mullein flowers are, when I go out there early in the morning, there's a particular area in the garden that's designated to Greek mullens, because literally it will just, hundreds of mullein plants will just reseed everywhere. So I kind of leave an area for them. And I like to go there early in the morning, like at maybe 6 o'clock, when the sun first starts to hit that part of the garden. And again, all I'll hear is bees, and not just honeybees. I mean, all kinds of native bees. They just love the Greek mullein. So another one really to consider. And there's our friend. Everybody knows there's a little caterpillar that we're looking for that was in a milkweed plant. There she is, getting ready to turn into there. So again, there's the Mexican sunflower, that beautiful reminder for the monarch. And then there's the monarch on the rose hips. So again, the Rosa rugosas, I didn't really say very much, but Rosa rugosas have naturalized themselves here on the coast of Maine. Rosa rugosa, from what I understand, is originally from China. But for us here in Maine, the Rosa rugosas grow really, really well. And again, if you come to visit us, I have a Rosa rugosa garden, and I have a long hedgerow of Rosa rugosas. And they start to bloom for us usually around the summer solstice, and they'll bloom into late July. Now we compete a little bit with the Japanese beetles. We used to not have Japanese beetles, but they really come north. So I do hand pick them, and then I give up. But I get a lot of beautiful rose petals, and then we get the beautiful rose hips in the fall. But the monarchs and the bees really, really appreciate the rose flowers. There's the echinacea with the monarch that we talked about. Different types of bees love the echinacea flowers that we talked about. That's one corner of the garden, again, showing kind of what it is to grow a whole grouping of a particular species that will really make the pollinators happy. And then the yellow swallowtail loves comfrey flowers. And again, I just learned that by watching. And so I just, really encourage you all, just watch. It's just amazing to watch. So there they are, the yellow swallowtail. The comfrey, I just say to people, if you're afraid of comfrey, just grow it on the, off in a corner of your garden, or off in the corner of your yard. and let it grow there, and you will have happy, happy butterflies and bees. And every now and then I've seen a ruby-throated hummingbird also. And the comfrey will bloom, you know, it blooms in May when the yellow swallowtails are coming back. And then if you cut it down and put those leaves in your compost pile, you know, it'll come back again. So comfrey is certainly worthy of considering to grow for the pollinators. There it is, the beautiful flowers, comfrey. And yeah, the last I wanted to end with, Gary Lawless was raised here in Belfast, Maine. You are very proud to have an amazing poet. And I love this poem he wrote. When the animals come to us asking for our help, will we know what they are saying? When the plants speak to us in their delicate, beautiful language, will we be able to answer them? And when the planet herself sings to us in our dreams, will we be able to wake ourselves and act? So beautiful, Gary Lawless poem. So I'm happy to answer a few questions if anybody has a question. Maybe we can turn the lights on, maybe. Yes.
You had mentioned about the Mexican sunflower to do like a hedgerow.
Yes.
Would you just direct seed that, or would you have to do
I've never had it reseed in my garden, and I've grown a lot of it. I would definitely, and this is, we are a short growing season here. So I would really, if you can, start it from seed early enough.
Okay.
Like late April, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, third week of April, something like that. And if you have a place to start it, better to do it indoors.
Okay.
It'll give you a jump. We transplant them when they're about this tall.
Okay.
What I do is I start them in little plugs, and then I transplant them into little bigger pots. And I really found, I've learned so much over the years just through trial and error, but, you know, when you transplant things, because often, you know, times are not putting them out until early June, they'll be much happier of a root system if you transplant them into a little bit of a bigger pot. It's amazing. And they have a better chance of really surviving. So if you can, you'll also find that I've seen them for sale at the Belfast Co-op too, the Mexican sunflowers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a question.
Do you have, in one of your handouts, did you have a list of all these various plants?
It's a great question.
What's the answer?
You're going to see it. I'm pretty sure it's on Avena's website.
Okay.
And more than just I talked about tonight.
Yeah.
And I am going to put it in the back of my book. And then also we sell a simple little poster, which I'm out of right now at Avena. But if you come to visit us, and it's just a poster that lists all different types of flowers for different butterflies and for bees and for hummingbirds. So, but I'm pretty sure you're going to see on Avena's website.
Okay. I didn't bring a pen, so I wasn't able
okay.
to. And then your Solomon's seal, how do you make medicine out of that?
So Solomon's seal is one that likes to grow in a community, from my experience, and from talking to different Native American herbalists. It's not one that, if you just put one plant in, it would be very unhappy.
Yes.
It really likes, well, it likes to grow, and then you'll see how it really, it masses itself, and it's all intertwined yeah. and connected. And the Native people say when you go to dig it, like in the fall when the plant starts to die back, they say it's best to dig it with a wooden implement. This is an old tradition, and that you want to be very, very careful when you go to dig it. You don't want to be breaking it. You want to kind of be wrestling it out. Because, you know, they are individual plants, but they're all kind of interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
So you just want to be very careful when you take it out. So I make a tincture from it. I just chop it up and add it, you know, into
the root of it.
The root of it.
So you clean it off real good, I guess.
I just wash it and chop it up. And then I put it in a glass jar and I cover it with like a vodka and let it sit for a month. You know, and I mean, I tend to put things in a blender and really macerate them
yeah.
so that more of the surface area of the plants is exposed to the solvent,
sure.
which is drawing out the medicinal properties.
And then you just bottle that?
Yeah, and then for an adult, usually I say, you know, you take a quarter to a half a teaspoon 3 times a day and a little bit of water. When I was starting to work in the garden with Heather, we were doing some stone wall work, and I actually got tendonitis in
yeah.
here, and it... Solomon's seal was amazing. Within a month of taking it, my tendonitis had resolved, and I was also topically rubbing the oil on it too.
So the oil
you can make an oil too from it.
With the root again,
mm-hmm.
you just put it in olive oil.
Mm-hmm. And I chop it up really fine, and then I infuse it in olive oil in a warm place for 2 weeks. And then you can pour that off, and you have a really nice Solomon's seal root oil. And it smells almost a little bit nutty. The smell of a Solomon's seal root oil. It's a phenomenal plant.
I have a big clump of it, and I've been trying to get rid of it, giving it away. You know?
I would take some. I'm
well,
about to
for your list of
yes, absolutely. I would totally trade you with them. You'll also find that Solomon seal in the spring, the deer come and nibble. Anybody seen that? They love to. They love. I mean, I went out one day. I was just like, oh, they just like come in and just grazed. So that's. I don't know if you've had that problem with your big clump. But
it's not where the deer would. They go to the vegetable garden
first.
Eat my chard and beet greens.
That's what I should do. I should grow vegetables around it. That's a good reminder.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainside. I'd rather see your hand. I'd rather swim the ocean. I'd rather not pretend. I'd rather do some thinking now. Somehow it all depends. If I could fly see my hometown. I'd rather hold my wife. I'd rather never question things. That's the story of my life. I'd rather not be crying. I'd rather just be whole. I'd rather brave the cleansing fire. I'd rather feed my soul. If I could fly away from me to ride this wind above the tree. Open to suggestions, I'm crying out to you. I'm ready to be finished here. I'm ready for this season to be if I could fly away from me to ride this wind above the trees, and oh, to fly away. Come and face the longing, whoa, on my knee. Yeah, yeah. Come and the longing.